From the Sky News Centre at 6, a group of children have been injured, two of them critically, after being hit by a car in Liverpool. It happened outside a school in the Toxteth area. Six 11 to 13-year-olds have been taken to hospital. The car's driver, who's thought to be in her 80s, was treated by paramedics at the scene. Rolf Harris has been charged with seven more counts of indecent assault. He's already serving a six-year jail sentence for sex offences. Matt Steele has more.
Police have been investigating claims made by seven women against the entertainer as part of Operation Yew Tree. They date back as far as 1971. The victims were aged between 12 and 27 at the time of the alleged incidents. Today, the Crown Prosecution Service has decided to authorise the charges, saying it believes they're in the public interest. The 85-year-old will appear before magistrates next month.
Prosecutors have accused footballer Adam Johnson of abusing his revered position in society when he had sexual contact with a 15-year-old fan. The 28-year-old denies two counts of sexual activity with a child. He's pleaded guilty to two other charges. Drug giant GlaxoSmithKline says it's considering an appeal after being fined £38 million for paying other companies not to make a rival antidepressant. Competition authorities say it meant the NHS paid over the odds for Seroxat. A celebration of the life of Jimmy Hill is taking place at Coventry Cathedral. The legendary former footballer, manager, administrator and broadcaster died in December at the age of 87. He was both manager and chairman at Coventry City. Football Association chairman Greg Dyke says Hill was a maverick.
It's special. He had a special talent. And he had that funny chin and all those sorts. You know, he was, I mean, you knew him. I mean, as a footballer, even as a footballer, you knew him because no one had a beard in those days and he had this strange beard.
And The Independent will no longer be published as a newspaper. The title will move online only from March. The sister paper, The Eye, has been sold off. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
When you look at a corporation, just like when you look at a slave owner, you want to distinguish between the institution and the individual. So slavery, for example, or other forms of tyranny are inherently monstrous. But the individuals participating in them may be the nicest guys you can imagine. Benevolent, friendly, nice to their children, even nice to their slaves, caring about other people. I mean, as individuals, they may be anything. In their institutional role, they're monsters because the institution's monstrous.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Tory policy wonk Oliver Letwin, 1988 plan to privatise the NHS is unfolding as we speak. Yes, he was the dubious brains behind the poll tax for Margaret Thatcher, along with Victor Rothschild and William Waldegrave. The Tory MP Oliver Letwin, he wrote a pamphlet way back in 1988 setting out plans to privatise the National Health Service. Despite his denials, those exact plans are unfolding as we speak. So, as Jeremy Hunt hits the NHS with a torpedo, saying he's going to impose new contracts, strikes at the NHS. But will they just end up being part of the destruction of the service they're trying to save, the doctors? Plus, we don't rob banks, we own them. The City of London is money laundering capital of the world. More evidence the real criminals have their hands firmly on the purse strings. And sex, lies and Julian Assange. The Western world's most powerful publisher under house arrest in London still. But Swedish doctors have come to his rescue. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspot. But first, we speak to Neurology Registrar Richard Ibitoy. He's chair of the Seven Committee of the British Medical Association Regional Junior Doctors Committee. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi.
Richard, tell us a little bit about your medical qualifications.
So I am a registrar in neurology. I'm 6.5 years post-graduating from medical school. And like many people between the age of 24 and 40, I am a junior doctor.
So we think of junior doctors as young people like yourself. How old are you?
31.
But many of them aren't. So what is exactly a junior doctor?
It's essentially anyone who is not a consultant or a GP.
And give us an idea of what your medical qualifications are. What kind of work are you doing in the health service at the moment?
So I'm based at a hospital. I see patients on the ward. I run clinics. I take phone calls and answer questions to other doctors across the region on the specialty of neurology.
Where did you do your training, and how long was it for?
In the University of Cambridge for 6 years.
And what's your experience been of negotiating this contract? When did it all start?
Well, I haven't personally negotiated it, but the negotiations, I gather, started in 2013 or so, and they quickly became unpleasant as the rules were changed unilaterally halfway through and continued to be imposed.
So what is your role then?
So my role is I represent the junior doctors in this region, the region of Seven, which is a geographic region, to the BMA, and I take their views forwards to the Junior Doctors Committee, which negotiates with the government.
Okay, give us an idea of some of the things you've been dealing with to do with this dispute.
So it's mainly junior doctors quite anxious and worried about their future. They don't know what their pay will be in August. They're worried about whether they could afford their mortgages, and they're worried about the disenfranchisement that's resulted from the government decision to revalue their Saturdays.
So is it all about Saturdays?
No. It's about treating junior doctors and doctors in general fairly in a manner that makes them feel rewarded and also allows our hospitals to have enough staff to keep going and look after our patients.
What for you has been the sort of touchstone of this? How have you managed to get your head around what's going on for your members? And I mean, I'm assuming you're elected, aren't you?
Yes, I am elected. So essentially the way I see the whole matter is it's asking for more from the junior doctors whilst offering a bit less. And I'm sure it's not the first time this has occurred in other parts of the public sector otherwise, but that's the fundamentals. They're asking for more in terms of Saturday being a normal working day without offering any more doctors to support the service.
How do you think this is going to affect things? Because this is one of the things that actually going on strike does is it actually disrupts the hospitals more. I mean, that is what Jeremy Hunt will be saying, is that actually the doctors, what we're doing is we have got a better system. And also, partly, he's saying that as part, one of our manifesto pledges was to have a 7-day National Health Service, and the junior doctors are trying to stop that.
Well, I mean, the junior doctors are not trying to stop that. I mean, the BMA itself has a position that they agree that we need to, you know, get better 7-day services and care. All the junior doctors have been striking about is their concern that if this comes in the way the government, at least if it came in the way the government initially suggested, then you might not have enough junior doctors to staff the NHS. So you'll have a bigger problem in August, a problem that far exceeds one day of strike action or two.
Well, John Snow from Channel 4 News spoke to Jeremy Hunt yesterday, and he asked him about this whole idea of the 7-day NHS, because obviously it was a manifesto commitment. The Conservatives last May got elected on this.
Secretary of State, in a sense, you've become something of a hate figure. How does that feel?
Well, it's never easy, but I think you have to also understand what the job of Health Secretary involves. Sometimes you have to speak out for quite difficult issues to do with patient care.
The problem here is that the poison that this whole process, which has been so badly handled, has kicked up, is now going to be itself damaging to patient care. And if patient care is your priority, you should have sorted this out in some other way.
Well, we have been trying to sort this out through a patient process of negotiation for the best part of 4 years. And in June, having won an election and it being in our manifesto to have a seven-day NHS, I again asked the BLA to sit round the table and discuss it, and they refused. And even before any discussions had happened, they balloted for strike action. And I think that is incredibly disappointing. And yes, that does leave some poison, and I think it's highly regrettable, because I don't think that what I want is different to what any doctor in the NHS wants, which is to give the safest possible care to patients, to be able to promise every patient using the NHS that we're going to have the same high-quality care every day of the week.
So, I mean, firstly, we already have high-quality care every day of the week, and junior doctors are part of that. We work every single day of the week, every hour of the day. It's manifestly untrue that the BMA balloted for strike action prior to discussion. They did so after years of imposition that were being named negotiations. But fundamentally, we all want the best for our patients, and the only reason that any junior doctor I've spoken to is resisting this is because they feel it will cause a recruitment crisis in the NHS and understaff our hospitals.
And what will that mean for you?
It means that since I'll be around in August, that I might find myself working longer hours for the same or less pay.
And what about others? Because they may possibly leave. I mean, that's one of the questions, the next question, in fact, that John Snow put to the Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt.
You said you'd done some new modelling today when you were in Parliament. And did you model the effect on the health service of doctors who leave? Which will, even if, let's say, suppose it's 1% of junior doctors, that's 540 doctors. Have you factored that in?
Well, I hope it doesn't come to that. And I think it's very important.
Well, it's going to if you impose this deal.
Well, I think it will depend on what people think when they actually look at what I've said. The contract that we are going to introduce is not the contract I originally wanted. Originally, we talked about Saturday being treated completely as a normal day of the week. I said, actually, I'm going to impose the contract. The NHS have told me, after a long process of negotiation, they think is fair and reasonable. So what I did was we started a negotiation saying that we have to sort out the problem of weekend rostering. We have to make it easier for hospitals to roster at weekends. We listened to what doctors were saying. We changed our position to try and reflect those concerns. In fact, we've changed it several times.
Right.
At no time in that process was the BMA prepared to move at all.
So, I mean, I am concerned that doctors or many doctors will choose to leave or choose not to return from sunnier climates come this come August with this new contract. The reason being that the generation of doctors coming after us, for example, the medical students, risk a significant pay cut relative to what we're getting. That's why we're being pay protected. As they calculate on their own website, the majority of doctors currently working need protection to stop this contract cutting their pay. All that means is the new doctors will have lower pay and less incentive to work in the UK.
So this really just is about pay, is it?
No. It's about the recruitment crisis that will occur in August as a result of a change in the contract that doctors don't think is fair for them or fair for their patients.
Also, Saturdays, he's made it quite clear there that he has moved on that to make sure that it's not just treated as any other day, Saturday. And the junior doctors are still saying they don't want anything to do with his contract.
Well, 9 to 5 on a Saturday, to me, you know, the way I have my week and the way I spend time with family and friends is very different to every other day. So the movement is a numerical one. It's one of, from I think, from 10 p.m. to 5 p.m. It still has most of what people call Saturday as a normal working day, which it is not.
The next question that was put to him, this is the Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt, by John Snow on Channel 4 News, was that what happens if the doctors just simply don't sign this contract?
Where we are is you having to impose this contract. What will you do if doctors don't sign the contract?
What I'm doing today is designed precisely to avoid that, because the decision I've taken, when you impose a contract as a Secretary of State, you could choose to do anything, because you're saying that the negotiation process has failed. So I could have said Saturday is going to be treated exactly like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I didn't. I took a very reasonable position. This has been a position that's been backed by Simon Stevens, the head of NHS England, by respected chief executives.
Well, you say that, but of course several of the ones you named have actually tweeted that whilst they supported the deal, they did not support imposition.
What I didn't say, people have different views on imposition, but what I said was that
Well, imposition is what I'm asking.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is these people have said that this was a fair and reasonable deal.
So So the problem is that actually you cannot really refuse to sign a contract in this sense. If once a contract is offered, a doctor's only option is either to resign or not to take up a job or not to apply. Refusing to sign a contract would make no difference to its validity in law. So it puts doctors in a very difficult position.
Why is that?
Well, because it essentially is asking doctors that if, you know, the main way they can resist this contract is simply by not applying for the jobs in the first place. There is no way, once it's imposed, for a doctor to reasonably say no to it.
Final question was about consultants, because I know you're not a consultant, Richard, but they're the next in line to have their contracts renegotiated. And I wonder whether potentially Jeremy Hunt has decided to impose this contract because the longer the junior doctor's contract takes to negotiate, that means that he can't really start with on the consultants, although, of course, he has already started. It's just going to delay it, potentially. Anyway, let's hear that question from Channel 4 News' John Snow to the Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt.
Far more complicated is to try to negotiate with the consultants, who are utterly vital at the weekend, even more vital than the junior doctors, who already do enormous numbers of hours beyond what they're paid for. Now, the consultants, are you going to impose that solution too?
Well, we've had much better discussions with the consultants, interestingly also represented by the BMA, but they have been willing to sit down and talk with us right from the start. We've actually made some very good progress in those discussions. So we'll have to see what happens.
So negotiations have actually already occurred and almost reached a conclusion with the consultants. The only thing that we are waiting for is for the Department of Health to finalise the agreed contract and so that it can be sent back to the BMA for consultation. I think it's a difficult matter. I suspect that the advantage of imposing the junior doctor contract is that it avoids a dual conflict with the consultants and junior doctors at the same time. I don't think it's because of negotiations.
So how do you think this is all going to pan out, Richard? And I mean, if you would, I know you don't have a crystal ball up at the hospital, but if you did have one.
So fundamentally, the concern and the risk, which I don't know how much, to what extent it will manifest, is that in August we will have a fundamental question, which is that what proportion of the doctors who would normally work in the NHS in August will still be there as junior doctors? And if that proportion, as John Snow pointed out, is just 1% less, that has significant effects on the service we're able to provide and on patient safety and care. And that's my concern, and that's what I think we risk.
Just looking at the figures, well, he said 540 junior doctors would go, which is quite a lot. I mean, that implies there are around 55,000 in the country. Is that roughly right?
That's correct.
What about here? How many junior doctors do you represent as part of your committee? I imagine I certainly didn't prepare you for that, but I mean, we're talking about, I would imagine, North Bristol Trust, United Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust. Give us a ballpark figure, okay, roughly.
So seven as a geographical area includes Bath, Cheltenham, Gloucester, Taunton, and etc. So I think an estimate will be around 3,000 doctors.
Okay, so one of the things that's come out in the last week or so is that Jeremy Hunt personally, apparently, this is according to The Independent, the paper which is won't be there in a month's time, it personally vetoed the deal which would have ended the junior doctor's strike. He's saying that actually that some of the civil servants as well as managers in the health service were in favour of the terms which were on the table, but Jeremy Hunt vetoed them.
That is correct. This is a very bullish move and essentially puts quite a big gamble upon the NHS in terms of vetoing a deal that many parties agreed to.
But he holds all the cards in one way, doesn't he? As you said, with the contract, the junior doctors have no choice but to sign it, to accept it, or else just leave the profession or go abroad.
Yes, but he does not hold the cards and the freedom of human movement or people's choices, and that is the card that will cause the biggest risk. We're fortunate to live in a country where we are free to choose, and I suspect that many will choose that they don't want this and they will vote with their feet.
What does that mean, that there just simply will not be doctors in hospitals to care for people?
Well, not enough of them, and therefore there will be risks, and we might be heading back towards long hours and tired doctors and risky patient care.
Also, Channel 4 News did a fact job. I've been plugging Channel 4 News a bit too much this week, actually, but with Michael Crick's report as well. But they did a fact check on this, and they're asking is how much the doctor strike is actually about patient safety. On the face of it, they say no. The government's offer to junior doctors set out in November last year claimed that the new contract would limit unsafe hours. Changes include a ban on scheduling shifts over 13 hours, limiting days or nights on call to 7, and preventing doctors from working more than 4 nights in a row or more than 5 consecutive long day shifts. The absolute limit on hours would fall from 91 to 72 a week. Junior doctors would continue to work on average 48 hours a week as laid out by the European law, which is 56 hours for those who opt out of the working time directive. Now, that sounds a bit long-winded, lots of facts and figures in there, Richard, but actually what they're saying, Channel 4 anyway, are saying in their fact check, is that actually this doesn't really have much at all to do with patient safety. Much more about just about the money.
That'll be quite incorrect. I mean, hours limits are barely worth the paper they're written on. In the 1970s, doctors had 40-hour weeks, apparently, but none of them worked it. The world worked 100-hour weeks. It was only this current contract and the fact that it imposed quite clear safeguards and penalties on hospitals that brought those hours down to, on average, less than 48 hours a week. Those are the fundamental safeguards the government was absolutely insistent had to go. So if you remove the only safeguard that prevents doctors overworking their shifts and hours and then create a set of rules that you know cannot be enforced, what's the outcome? It doesn't mean anything.
Interesting. Also, another... this is actually from a year and a half ago. It's not exactly news, but I'm going to lob this in your direction, Richard, as well. The National Health Service comes top in a healthcare survey. A study by a Washington-based foundation puts healthcare provision in the United States at the bottom. Interesting, isn't it, since the policy of Jeremy Hunt seems to be to move the British healthcare more towards the US model, from the top in the world down to the bottom in the world. The National Health Service has been declared the best healthcare system by an international panel of experts who rated its care superior to countries which spend far more on health. The same study also castigated healthcare provision in the US as the worst of the 11 countries that looked at. Despite putting the most money into health, America denies care to many patients in need because they do not have health insurance and is the poorest, saving the lives of people who do fall ill. The reports produced by the Commonwealth Fund, a Washington-based foundation, which is respected around the world for its analysis of the performance and different countries' health systems. UK ranks first overall, scoring highest on quality, access and efficiency. The fund's researchers conclude in their 30-page report. The findings amount to a huge endorsement of the health service, especially as it spends the second lowest amount on healthcare amongst the 11. That is just £2,000 a week per head, less than the second lowest amount on healthcare amongst those 11. Is half of the £5,000 in the United States. Only New Zealand spends less. In the Commonwealth Fund study, the UK came out first of the 11 countries in 8 of the 11 measures of care that the authors looked at. It got top place on measures including providing effective care, safe care, coordinated care and patient-centred care. The fund also rated the NHS as the best for giving access to care and for efficient use of resources, Richard. What do you make of that report? It sounds actually like a big pat on the back for you guys.
I think we are very fortunate to have the NHS, and I think it is a very efficient system, as you point out. And I think that this system depends very much on the goodwill of the staff within it and how happy they are to do the work and how happy they are to go above and beyond the call of duty to keep the service going. This is why I think these changes fundamentally undermine goodwill, morale, and potentially the NHS.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, the NHS also outperforms the other countries, which include France, Germany and Canada, in managing the care of people who are chronically ill, the report said. Dr. Mark Porter, who's leader of the Doctors Union, the British Medical Association, said the fund's findings were clear evidence that our much maligned NHS is the top performing health system in the world.
Well, I think there's only doubt about that. I mean, you mentioned New Zealand there as being slightly cheaper. That's because the Labour government in New Zealand abolished the internal market. We still have an internal market in the NHS in Britain, with the provider-producer split, or what is it, with the purchaser-provider split and all the rest of it. that's actually counterproductive, and the last Labour government should have abolished it and didn't. And if we abolished it, we could further improve our efficiency, because in actual fact, planning is superior to pseudo markets.
Richard, you say people enjoy working in the National Health Service. Why is that?
Well, it's very rewarding to be part of a system where individuals don't have to worry that if they fall ill, they'll have to, you know, figure out how to pay for it with a loan. We don't have to sell our houses should our illness be serious or prolonged. I think we are all, as doctors, happy to help in a system where we know it, which we know is fair to the individuals when they turn up at the door.
Martin, I know this system had its origins really in the bombing of the Second World War and the carnage of the Second World War. In the mid-1940s, the Labour government that came into power in 1945, at the end of the Second World War, thought this was a good idea.
Yes, and of course, at the time, the BMA were rather opposed to the National Health Service, but that was a long time ago. I think the professional support that the NHS gives to doctors has become something that they value. Don't forget, before the NHS, doctors were independent entrepreneurs, really, and there's continuous pressure to go back to the old system, even though everybody knows that it didn't work, and clearly in the United States it doesn't work. It's presented as, oh, well, we've got to reform. We don't want to get rid of the NHS. We just need to reform it a bit. But, of course, in actual fact, what they're doing is introducing market principles into something which was set up not to be based on market principles. It doesn't matter if you've got a bit of waste in a system where you're trying to make sure that everybody gets a decent healthcare coverage. That's far more efficient than mopping up the mess of trying to cost every single thing that you doing. So, for example, when the Tories in the 1980s thought they would save money by buying in blood products from the United States rather than expanding the blood donation system in Britain, it was cheaper, but it then turned out that all this blood was actually infected with HIV, AIDS, etc. So these are false economies, and the NHS is a socialist organisation. It's a top-down planned organisation, and even with the internal market that's been enforced, it's still got some of those features. But of course, it could be a better organisation if the internal market was got rid of, as they did in New Zealand.
What was it about the Second World War, Martin, you think that made people think that the NHS was a good idea to go for?
Well, obviously, the thing of bombing of cities and so on, you can't go around as you're dragging people out of the rubble saying, have you got health insurance? Doesn't make any sense, does it? And, of course, then the whole idea that health should be outside the market, that people shouldn't have to worry about finance when they're ill. It's a massive, massive increase in people's mental health when they realise that if you get ill, you're not going to lose your house, family aren't going to be made destitute and so on. The major cause of bankruptcies in the US is people getting ill. And that's, can you imagine how that makes people feel? When, the fear of getting ill is not just the fear of the illness itself, it's the fear of leaving your loved ones with massive debts when you die.
This idea of not having to sort of check to see how much money you're getting for every patient, Richard, what difference does it actually really make, though, in practice?
In practice, it means that we actually, as doctors, deliver far better care, because we're not focused on whether it pays us well to do a test. We're focused on only on whether the test helps the patient. It leads to very rational, very efficient clinical practice, and it's something that elsewhere in the world they identify as a feature of the NHS service.
So are you saying that for some systems, not like the National Health Service, that a doctor is constantly thinking, well, how much is this test going to cost, and can the patient afford it, and is this a test that I can make some money out of? Because that sounds to me as if you're starting to put the clinical decisions down, or almost throw them in the dustbin.
Absolutely. I mean, I have no personal experience of the US or other healthcare models. From what I've read and what I understand, you, on average, will be subjected as a patient to a greater number of individual tests, because each individual test has a financial reward for the clinician, for the insurer, for the hospital, and once practice becomes established like that, it becomes a pattern that then extends and just grows over time.
Another story to do with the health dispute, David Cannon. This is in the Canary. I think this is Martin, isn't it from Cuba or something, the Canary newspaper? Am I right? I don't know.
You
have heard of it? Anyway, it says the Cameron has just launched a privatisation surge to end the National Health Service by the time he leaves office. A huge increase in the number of NHS contracts handed out to private firms has led to concerns the UK may be heading towards a costly insurance-based healthcare system like that in the US. The Health and Social Care Act 2012 completely changed the English NHS system. It means that the health secretary is no longer responsible for the NHS due to a hands-off clause, which gives power to commissioning groups. This means 38 Degrees has said the responsibility for securing the provision of healthcare services will lie with unelected commissioners who will only be accountable to an unelected national quango. Strategic centres of the NHS, such as strategic health authorities and primary health care trusts, were dismantled. This effectively denationalised the service, removing the economies of scale and guarantees of standardised service, regardless of where you live in the country, leading, I suppose, to a postcode lottery. This paved the way to ensure that up to 50% of beds in any NHS hospital can be handed over to private providers. I think some of these changes that have been going on, Richard, have maybe gone above our head. I don't know if you've seen any evidence of these kinds of big strategic changes and changes of responsibility for the health secretary have actually made any real difference in the health service.
I think, as a junior doctor in general, the answer is no. I am aware, however, that, for example, some parts of our training, some parts of the health service have been bought by private providers, and in some small ways it has served to undermine the national contract that we have anyway, such that doctors are being asked to pay fees they would otherwise not pay, such as for checking their criminal records and so on, which normally the NHS would pay. But in general, doctors are not directly affected yet by this, but I suspect we will in future.
Martin, Serco took on a 3-year contract worth £140 million to run community health services in Suffolk. Before they landed the contract, the four-hour response targets for nurses and therapists to meet patients was achieved 97% of the time. However, in November 2013, Serco only managed 90% of the time. Well, it's actually 89.3% of the time, leading to concerns about the services that they were providing. We've also had some of these private healthcare providers collapse completely.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that the NHS used to do virtually everything in-house. I mentioned blood products earlier. But what they've done is they've said any competent provider can bid. And at first, they were going to say any provider can bid. Now it's any competent provider, I think. I can't remember the exact wording. But, of course, that once you've taken the way international treaties work, things like the European treaties that we've signed up to, once you start allowing private sector bids for NHS contracts, then they can sue you if you don't choose the cheapest bid. And I think a lot of the doctors' consortiums which have been set up, and don't forget, before the last election, David Cameron promised that there would be no top-down reorganisation of the health service, and then immediately brought one in. But, of course, by introducing it in a small way, you then open a legal coach and horses that can be driven through. And don't forget, you've got all of these companies based in the United States who provide private healthcare and private health insurance, who licking their lips, looking at the British National Health Service and thinking, hey, there's a load of money to be made there. And I think that this is the principle of the National Health Service is that it's a nationalised industry, and that's been gradually undermined and wasn't properly protected by the Labour government when they had 13 years in power. They should have abolished the internal market. That's what happened in New Zealand. That's why New Zealand is cheaper. Provides not as quite as good as ours, but a cheaper health service than we can provide, because they got rid of the internal market.
Final story, which I mentioned at the top of the hour, was in the Mirror. A Tory policy chief, Oliver Letwin, wrote a blueprint for NHS privatisation. The Mirror says this is by Mikey Smith. Two of the five proposals, which included introducing charges for all NHS services, have already been adopted. Tory policy Chief Oliver Letwin wrote a radical blueprint for privatising the NHS. It was revealed today. That was the 8th of January, actually. David Cameron's right-hand man co-penned a document for an influential think tank which contains a string of ideas that have already been introduced by the Tories, including the increased reliance on private companies, but it also calls for the principle of the NHS being free at the point of use to be scrapped and even for patients to be charged for every service. Mr Letwin denies the ideas of informed Tory health policy, despite two key suggestions in the pamphlet being made law. But as recently as 2004, Mr Letwin told a private meeting the NHS would cease to exist within 5 years of a Tory government. And as a cabinet office minister, he said he paid a particular attention to Andrew Lansley's hated health and social care bill, boasting he'd been through it line by line. The establishment of the National Health Service as an independent trust, which became NHS England, and the increased use of private providers were central planks of the Health and Social Care Act. Next, his pamphlet proposed a scrapping of the principle the NHS is free at the point of use, suggesting a tentative exploration of charging for every service. Mr Letwin said, "This pamphlet, written many years ago, no longer represents my views on the management of the NHS and has no relevance to the policy on the NHS adopted and pursued by this government now or in the future." And Jonathan Ashworth from the Labour Party said the Tories have made it harder to see a GP, pushed up waiting lists and plunged hospitals into financial crisis. This is yet more evidence that you simply cannot trust the Tories with the NHS. I'll spare you on this one, Richard, for a moment. I think I'll just go to Martin. Oliver Letwin, this guy, certainly does seem that even though he denies it, that certain items in his little list of things he wanted to do to the NHS in 1988 have actually happened.
Well, what you've got is, on one level, the Tories want to present themselves as the NHS is safe in their hands and that they like the NHS and so on. I mean, David Cameron going on about his disabled son having NHS support and all the rest of it. Of course, lots of his mates don't use the NHS. So let's face it, there's quite a lot of people at the top in our society who do not use the NHS. So the idea that that it's safe in their hands is questionable. But of course, there's been a long-term goal of right-wing elements within the Conservative Party to get rid of the National Health Service because they see it, quite rightly, as a bastion of socialist thinking in our society. And the NHS is a big organisation. It employs a lot of people. And if you're going to take all of that out of the market, then that's a substantial chunk of Britain's GDP taken out of the market for good, forever. And of course, in other countries, that's not the case. And they desperately want to marketise it because that's what they do and they believe in the market.
Richard, your final thoughts then on what's happening here. Maybe you could also just tell us, when were you last working? When are you going back to work over the next few days? And also, the big question has got to be to you, direct question, is will you sign this contract?
So I was working today. I'll be back at work again on Monday. I genuinely don't know my plans for August because I have applied for a research post and I'll have to see what comes of that. If I got that post, I would not be signing this contract, just by definition. But if I didn't, I would be here and I would work within this contract because I have a period of time left in my training which I need to fulfil, and it simply isn't worth the cost of leaving for over a small amount to lose a lot, so I would stay and finish off my training. I can't comment on the kind of politics of the internal market, etc. But what I can say is that I do agree that the NHS is extremely efficient, and it is efficient because of its principles and its founding principles, and that if we change the NHS to not be free at the point of use, we would change the way people behave with illness, and we would risk people becoming more ill and risking their health before turning up to see a doctor.
Okay, Richard Ibitoy, you are a registrar and you're chair of the 7 committee of the BMA. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Thank you.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Martin, Julian Assange, really this is last Friday's story, I guess, isn't it? But there's been some more information come out since then about what was going on over in Sweden, and the Swedish, whole bunch of Swedish doctors saying, actually, we think that he should be released, that there's really no charges to answer him. They've got a whole list of points. What they're saying is, effectively, I've got a little list here. It's 10 different points. Assange has never been charged with any crime. No woman ever accused Mr. Assange of rape. Simultaneously, the Swedish media, contrary to principal rule in Sweden, rushed to cable the world that the founder of WikiLeaks was arrested, charged with rape in Sweden, which is just untrue. Then the chief prosecutor, Ava Finner, immediately dismissed the accusation put forward in the police report after she'd examined the case. The leading woman of the two scheduled to visit the police station was a personal friend of the police officer who performed interviews and interrogations, so it looks as if the police were possibly involved with that. The case was reopened at the initiative of the said law firm, Wardstrom and Borgstrom, that defended the women, so the lawyers have played a very active case here. The women accuser is a former Swedish embassy employee. She had been expelled from Cuba on charges of activities on behalf of the CIA. The same leading woman was at the time political secretary of the Brotherhood, a small organisation within the Swedish Social Democrat Party, where Justice Thomas Bodström was also a principal member. So also she had links to the legal profession who'd been dealing with this case. As Justice Minister, Bodström was a principal actor from the Swedish government in implementing CIA operations in Sweden, done in secret and against Swedish law. The initiative to open the case was taken by a selective prosecutor, Mrs. Marianne Nye, at the behest of the same Bodström and Bodström law firm. Now that statement was by Swedish Doctors for Human Rights on Assange's, Sweden's rejection of the UN ruling about the arbitrary detention of Julian Assange. So the Swedish government have rejected it, just as the British government have rejected it, but the Swedish doctors are saying it's a whole load of nonsense.
Well, I just don't understand, if he's not been charged with anything in Sweden, and he hasn't, how can there be an extradition request? You can't extradite people who haven't been charged with something.
It's called a European arrest warrant.
Well, yes, but I mean, it doesn't add up to me. And what Assange has been saying all along, if you want to come and interview me, then come to Britain and interview me. But if you want an extradition, then you've got to actually charge me with something. But they haven't sufficient evidence.
I mean, what the doctors have pointed out, I've not seen anywhere else. I don't think even the Sex, Lies and Julian Assange documentary Australian ABC television put out had this information, was that his principal accused was thrown out of Cuba because they believe she was working for the CIA, and also the government minister involved in this prosecution as well, very close ties to US intelligence.
Well, yes, and if you think about it, if you wanted to set Assange up, you just throw somebody at him at a party who's actually one of your agents, who then accuses you of rape. It's perfectly simple to do, and we know that they do things like that. So it's not unreasonable for Assange to think that he's been set up here. And I think the British government are complicit in this, as they're complicit in many of the CIA's misadventures.
Five key reasons the UN believes Assange detention is illegal. This is Telesur, which is the English language channel. Actually, this is a website with articles on it, but they do have an English language channel from Venezuela, Martin. They say Assange has indeed been effectively detained for over 5 years. They say he was subject to arbitrary detention long before he fled to the Ecuadorian embassy. They also say British authorities aren't just to blame. They're also blaming the Swedes. And that the UN has vindicated at least one key conclusion of the Ecuadorian investigation, which is to do with the fact that if he went to Sweden, he may be taken to the US. Finally, they say he must be freed immediately.
Well, that's right. I mean, this has been dragging on and dragging on. The fact is that they've wanted to set him up because he exposed some of their nefarious activities, and it looks like they set him up. It practically if they have tried to set him up, and this Swedish woman connected to the CIA has wrongly accused him, perhaps she should be the one that's in the dock and not Julian Assange at all.
Well, this all came up at Prime Minister's Questions again this week, so let's have a listen to that.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Julian Assange is accused of rape and is on the run. Despite this, a United Nations panel nobody has ever heard of declared last week that he has been arbitrarily detained and somehow deserving of compensation. Does my right honourable friend agree with me that this was a nonsensical decision, that Mr. Assange should hand himself over to the Swedish prosecutors, and that if anyone is deserving of compensation, it is the British taxpayer who has had to pay £12 million to police his Ecuadorian hideout?
My honourable friend is absolutely right. I think this was a ridiculous decision. You've got a man here with an outstanding allegation of rape against him. He barricaded himself into the Ecuadorian embassy and yet claims he was arbitrarily detained. The only person who detained himself was himself. And so what he should do is come out of that embassy and face the arrest warrant that is against him. He's being asked to stand trial in Sweden, a country with a fair reputation for justice, and he should bring to the end this whole sorry saga.
Well, I come back to my original point. He hasn't been charged with anything in Sweden. He hasn't.
Well, they're saying he's been accused of rape.
Yes, but that's... Really... But if you're going to extradite somebody, I would say you can't just accuse people. You've got to charge them. It's not... accusing somebody is not charging... If he's not been charged by the Swedish police, then he's not in a position to be extradited. Not in my view. If they haven't got enough...
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, Martin, it's also 2 years since something happened, isn't it?
The coup in Kiev.
I thought I'd be a bit cheeky and just throw that one at you. Yeah, it's exactly 2 years, really, to the day, pretty much, when there was a coup in Kiev in Ukraine. What have we learned since?
Well, I think that we became fairly clear fairly quickly what was going on. There's been a very good documentary on Canal Plus in France, which people can see online, I believe, now, and also academic research has carried out, which shows that the snipers who killed the so-called Holy Hundred of protesters and police officers are definitely linked to the current regime, not the Yanukovych regime. And the current regime, of course, is linked to NATO intelligence services. So it could very well be that some very highly placed British intelligence officers should be in the dock for that assassination of hundreds of, nearly 100 protesters and police officers 2 years ago. That's not the way it's being spun in our media.
So this is in Canal Plus in France, in French, so not in English, so we can't watch it, really.
It's up on the internet with subtitles now. But of course,
I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll put a link up to the show page tonight on to that one.
Yeah, and the
that is thisweek.org.uk.
There's more and more evidence is coming out that this was actually a brutal coup carried out by fascist paramilitaries with assistance from Western intelligence services. And we knew almost immediately that this was the case because of the intercepted phone call between Catherine Ashton, who was the British head of the EU's foreign policy operation, and Umas Piets, who was the Estonian foreign minister. And the Estonians are very hostile to the Russians, so they didn't have any reason to make this up. He told her that when he'd been gone round the hospitals and talked to the doctors, we've just been talking to a doctor on this show, he said, well, they saying that all of these people have been shot by the same calibre weapons, by snipers from various places, the Hotel Ukraina and the Opera, which were under the control of Pravi Sektor.
Well, they also actually reported on 2 years ago to the day, pretty much, on BBC Five Live, one of the reporters that was actually at the scene said that they believed that British bullets had been used.
Indeed. So, in other words, it's quite possible, just like the debacle in Syria, that British intelligence services are responsible for the coup. And don't forget, they killed nearly 100 liberal protesters. That's how cynical these people are. I say, well, they wouldn't do stuff like that. I say, NATO intelligence services have got a track record of doing stuff like that, and it looks like they did exactly the same thing 2 years ago. But of course, what goes around comes around, and ultimately, this will come out, and it won't hurt Putin, it will hurt them.
One of the problems, of course, in Ukraine is there's actually quite a lot of fascist and far-right paramilitary battalions involved, and I spoke about this aspect and others to Russia Today's political correspondent Mark Sleboda about this recently, and this is what he had to say. I really was trying to put to him some questions about, you know, if there is actually really much real evidence that the Kiev government of Ukraine at the moment is cooperating with the far right, with fascists, armed fascists.
During the Maidan, you know, you can check mainstream Western media reports for this, there was 15,000 people who marched on January 1st of 2014 in a torchlit ceremony at night honoring the birth of Stefan Bandera. But it goes far more than that, because the regime that has come to power in Ukraine, the U.S. and EU-backed you know, government that, you know, that seized power just a couple months after that, they have openly declared in law that these organizations that Bandera headed and was a part in, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army and their political wing, are the founding fathers of the state of Ukraine now, and that they are national heroes. And a step further, anyone who says otherwise can be imprisoned under law. And that would, of course, include any historians who happen to show up in Ukraine for research and say, hello, these were genocidal maniacs who collaborated with Hitler. They weren't national heroes. They shouldn't be your national heroes. This has received very scant attention in the Western press, who want to paint a very different perception of what this government is, who its leaders are, and who are these paramilitary battalions that fight for it
but
and
Mark,
what they believe in.
But Mark, isn't there some sort of, I mean, surely there must be some kind of law guidance or whatever with regard to the Pentagon and the EU funding, that money shouldn't be going to neo-Nazi, neo-fascist groups like the Azov Battalion, who are a kind of fascist, well, they are not a kind of, they are a fascist fighting group that are neo-Nazis. So surely we can't be funding them.
Well, Azov and right sector, of course, only the most egregious and popular, you know, the most publicized. Many of these battalions, you know, accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity by Human Rights Watch and others, you know, they are really just as guilty. Certainly the so-called liberal or neoliberal government, which sends them to you know, subjugate the, you know, parts of Ukraine that still resist their seizure of power. How can we not call them far right or fascist themselves if they're willing to knowingly use these people? But there was some attention drawn in the U.S. Congress, and the quite storied black congressman John Conyers, almost a year and a half ago now, put amendment into a Pentagon defense spending bill that was allocating money and weapons to prop up this regime, that specifically outlined that at least none of the funding should go directly to Azov Battalion, which is perhaps the most notorious and most openly neo-fascist of this regime's paramilitary organizations. Just in the last 2 weeks, at the Pentagon's insistence, this bill was dropped from the new U.S. defense spending bill. So now the U.S. government is free to directly arm a neo-Nazi paramilitary battalion serving the new government of Ukraine. Azov's neo-Nazi credentials are really something that even the most whitewashing of the Western press hasn't been able to deny. We've seen a whole host of political and you know, military actions. Of course, most egregious actions, Azov in particular, was against the citizens of Donbass. You know, they have been accused of various things by international organizations, you know, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. But of course, because the Ukrainian government, you know, has no desire to investigate them, you know, we haven't seen anything proven It's certainly not in any type of international context. But right now, they occupy the city of Mariupol, which, you know, at the right after the Maidan putsch, along with the rest of the Donbass, voted overwhelmingly, as even Western journalists were forced to admit at the time, the number of people turning out in the streets, to distance themselves, to seek some form of autonomy or independence from this new government that seized power, that they rejected. We know that the Azov has, for instance, there have been reports by an anti-Putin reporter, Anna Nemtsova, in Foreign Policy, that Azov battalion sitting in Mariupol is openly working with fighters, foreign fighters from Syria that were veterans of ISIS. All right, and this isn't coming from the Russian government. This is coming from a anti-Russian reporter that in Foreign Policy.
Well, the links between the crisis in the Ukraine and the crisis in the Syria are strong, in fact. And the link is destabilization by NATO intelligence services working with the Gulf Cooperation Council countries like Saudi Arabia. And there is clearly cooperation developing now between extremists of the Islamic type. There is an Islamic International Brigade fighting alongside the fascists against the Russians. At the same time, of course, in Syria, the situation is very tense now, because the Russians and the Syrian army are effectively winning the war.
And that was Mark Sleboda, who's a political editor or correspondent. I'm not quite sure what exactly his title is at the English language channel Russia Today. He's American. This Azov battalion, Martin, if you look them up, you see that they've got a kind of giant yellow flag with a giant black, what looks like a swastika, but with two of its little crooked cross arms snapped off. So, and they're all they don't actually, it seems, have a proper uniform. They look like kind of ordinary people who've dressed up in a bit of camo that they've got from a surplus store or something, with balaclavas on, that sort of thing.
Well, they're equivalent to Ulster Defence Association, perhaps, in Northern Ireland, which of course remained legal. Provisional IRA was always illegal. The Ulster Defence Association was legal. These are legal paramilitaries.
News as well from Digital Journal this week. The United States is to train the alleged Nazi Azov battalion in Ukraine. Many of the US Congress favour helping Ukraine in its battle against Russian-supported rebels in the east of the country. However, some of the militia groups associated with the struggle have neo-Nazi sympathies. Certainly if they've got Stefan Bandera's picture on their wall. That's the Digital Journal, Martin. Where's this heading, this Ukraine?
I think that they'd be foolish to escalate it, but they may well do so because they're very foolish people. And the same thing could happen in Syria. The Turks could invade Syria. They'll get a bloody nose if they do, but they may well do it, with the support of the British and the Americans, of course.
Finally tonight, drug money saved banks in global crisis, claims a UN advisor. This has been going around for a while. Drugs money worth billions of dollars kept the financial system afloat at the height of the global crisis. There's also a tremendous amount of evidence that the City of London, Martin, is the centre of the global drugs trade.
Well, quite likely so. I mean, the Transparency International rates Britain as a very transparent and it's all about perceptions, perceived to be a non-corrupt country. But, of course, other countries, the Saudi Arabias, Bangladeshis, Nigerias, they do all their dirty business in the City of London, and they get the blame, and we just get the money.
Ed Vuliemi, on the 26th of December last year, talked about Roberto Saviano. I'll put a link to that as well. He's living under armed guard. He says, actually, the City of London is where it all happens.
Are we surprised on this programme? I don't think we are, Tony, are we?
Okay, well, time. That's all we've got time for this week. We've got Mohammed Mokhtari just getting ready next door for his Arabian Nights. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, Noel Councillor Gary Hopkins. Thanks also to our doctor guest. This week on Dialect, which is dialectradio.co.uk, this week is Somerset's unofficial ambassador to Colombia. Also on our archive, St Paul's Carnival and People's Republic of Stokes Croft. ThisWeek.org.uk is our show page. I'm on Twitter @TonyGosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the